Let us start with an opening prayer. If you'll pray after me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all difficulties. Give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. Well, what should we talk about tonight? Did anybody come with any questions or any topics they would like to hear about? Something should come up, you can ask. One of the things that I had mentioned that I would be talking about tonight is spiritual experiences, including Kundalini experiences. There has been much written and much talked about in terms of Kundalini experiences. There have been people who have traveled around the country giving Kundalini workshops, trying to awaken the Kundalini, and that kind of thing. That there is much misunderstanding about what Kundalini is, I think there is. Number one, it's a natural force that is within all mankind. In the Garden of Eden, in Genesis, it talks about how the serpent tempted Eve, and with an apple from the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the midst of the garden. Eve succumbed to it and brought Adam with her. And as a result, they were taken out of the Garden of Eden. And there was a curse put onto the snake, saying that it must crawl upon its belly. Now, it's an interesting story to hear, but what does it mean? Within all of us is a tree with the roots at the top of the head and the trunk coming down as the spine and all the efferent and the afferent nerves coming out from the spine represent the tree of life within us. It's an upside down tree. And that the tree in the midst of the garden, the fruit, is the knowledge of good and evil. In the beginning, we are pure spirit, and we come into physical manifestation. We are meant to enjoy this world, but not to get a part of it, or not to get over-involved in it. But our consciousness gradually becomes attached to things of the world. And as a result, it seeks out to have greater and greater experience in the world. From the top of the head, where the Sahasrara, or the crown chakra, is the crowning achievement of mankind. That is where supreme superconscious exists. And different gradations of consciousness all the way down below it. In the midst of the garden is the sexual organs. And when the sexual organs become activated, then The life force is drawn down, and we come into a state of ignorance of duality, of the nature of good and evil. Instead of residing within ourselves and being complete within ourselves, we start seeking out a partner. We see our complement, our half, as being fulfilled by having a partner in this world. Now, from a human standpoint, we can say this is a totally natural occurrence. But from a spiritual standpoint, this is a lowering of the consciousness into the body. And when we see our complement, our other half, as being fulfilled within another person, and we don't experience that fulfillment, that completeness within, by the two opposites of the spine, from the bottom of the spine to the top of the spine, we lose consciousness of our spiritual connection, of our oneness with that omniscient, omnipresent consciousness from which we've all evolved, from which we've all become. And so we drop into this state of ignorance when we become totally imbued with this body consciousness, and that is symbolized most by looking for the complement outside of ourselves. Through this loss of spiritual connection, we remove ourselves from the Garden of Eden. We then have to work for our bread by the sweat of our brow. That it is said that in the Golden Age, that a man and a woman through thought could create a new being, a new baby. And so that power is lost, and conception needs to come through sexual union, and through that, the painful delivery that comes about through the womb. And so this is more and more reinforcement. Once we have children, then our consciousness moves further out into the world. We feel, of course, responsible for those children. More and more of our attachments move out into this world, and more blockage from our real spiritual status. Now, in reality, there is no separation. But not being conscious of the union with spirit, then we feel separate. It's a conscious separation. But the reality is that if you breathe, if you think, if you can move, you have divine consciousness moving through you by definition. You could not have any of those things if divine consciousness were not moving within you. But the thing is this, is that we're not conscious that it's divine presence. We come to think of ourselves as an isolated individual who is cut off from other human beings, seeks connection with them, occasionally gets connection, other times separation. And because of that, we start to feel loss, and the sorrow of loss, the grief of loss, and other times the pleasure of union. And so up and down we go in this world of good and evil, or this world of duality, positive and negative. For every good thing, there's a negative thing. For every high, there's a low. For every warm temperature, there's a cool temperature, and so on. It all vacillates between these two polar opposites. And so, as we look for pleasure, as we look for fulfillment, as we look for perfection in this body and in this world, we constantly come up short. We keep looking. We think we found it. Oh, I found just that perfect person. Well, we have them for a while, and all of a sudden we see all the flaws in that person, and they're no longer perfect. And then we think, oh, have I made a mistake or something? And so then we get the perfect house and the home that we've dreamed of. And then, well, it's keeps some maintenance needs to happen. And there's a leak in the roof, and the windows aren't right, and so they let in air and all the rest of it, so there's just constant maintenance made up in that. And so every time that we think we found some bit of perfection in this world, there's something that comes in to say, No, that's not it completely. And even if we were able to create a perfect life with the fulfillment of everything that we wanted, one day we leave this body and we leave everything of this world behind. So even if we have perfection in this world, we have to leave that, and that makes it imperfect also. So this is the dilemma that we find ourselves in by having directed the consciousness into body consciousness and becoming completely cut off from our spiritual origin. Now, the spiritual meaning of the serpent that is condemned to crawl upon its belly, the serpent represents this life force with this base at the spine. And it is picturesquely shown as a serpent wound 3.5 times around the base of the spine. And there it resides. You see, it's crawling upon its belly, or our lower three chakras, from the belly button down to the second chakra, down to the first chakra. And there it resides. It doesn't rise up any higher than that. So those are the three human ways of entering into this world. And so we're relegated to this body consciousness. Now, it's not that God puts a curse on it. This is very picturesque kind of language. But it is that this is a natural outcome when we focus our attention in this way and we guide our consciousness down into body consciousness and we become completely unaware of our divine origin. So this is the state of mankind when he comes into human consciousness, and this is why this is a story of the descent of divinity into humanity. Spiritual evolution has to do with reversing that trend, to draw that life force back up through the spine into the higher regions, into the heart center, the throat center, the ajna, the sahasrara, the crown chakra at the top. And so to reverse that, we need to learn how to refocus our attention. Meditation is the act of refocusing our attention here at the ajna, the kutasya chaitanya, the Christ center here. And by refocusing our attention there and becoming quiet and withdrawing all the life force from the body, just strictly by putting our full attention here, gradually life force is drawn back from this body, from all the extremities up through the spine and into this higher center. And it begins to awaken in us a sense of calm, a sense of peace, a sense of expanded consciousness, spontaneous joy, bliss, ananda. And through that, we feel that we are coming in touch with divine realms once again, our true spiritual nature. Now, when our intensity for realization of this universal consciousness becomes great enough, then it activates this force at the base of the spine that is normally dormant. And with a powerful movement of energy up through the spine and to the higher centers, this energy begins the transformational process that changes the very nature of this physical body, of our more subtle astral body, and our causal body, making them fit instruments for this divine consciousness. When I first experienced this activation in my own life, it was many years ago, and I was meditating with a group. I was very focused here at the ajna, when suddenly I felt it was as if a snap at the base of my spine, and a rush of energy came up and just pinned my attention. It was very forceful, very powerful, and pinned my attention here at the ajna. It began to heat up. I felt like I was a hot frying pan. It was so hot. Now, fortunately, I had the teachings of my own guru to let me know that this is a natural process that happens within every individual as they ascend from the human to the divine. So I didn't think that I had come down with some illness. I didn't think that there is some strange malady occurring within me. And so I had that mental reassurance that this was all right. This force lasted for some time, and then it gradually began to recede. This was my first experience in what was to become a constant experience or a reoccurring experience on a very frequent basis, time and time again. Now, as this force rises up in the spine, it's not just a one-time thing. And sometimes people come to these workshops where there's a seeking to awaken this kundalini force, and they have some tingling in their spine or at the top of the head, and they say, oh, I've awakened my kundalini. But this isn't the case. This is a direction of the life force that is normally active within our body, and it creates these sensations, and they can be very high, very wonderful sensations that occur. But that is not the kundalini. And so through the awakening of this kundalini, this very powerful force starts to work on our behalf. It starts to work through all the nerve channels, and particularly the center of the spine. In yoga is called the Sushumna. And on either side of these are the Ida and the Pingala, the sun and the moon sides. One is cooling and one is heat and activating. And so by guiding it up through the Sushumna and bringing it up to the Ajna, gradually then it comes to the Sahasrara, or the crown chakra. Now in between time, it puts us through many, many experiences. Many times I was made to sing. Now, it wasn't just because I felt like singing. This force started to activate me in a certain way that I had to sing, and just at a particular tune, just as a particular pitch. And if it wasn't quite right, it was forced to go a little bit up, a little bit down. And this was meant to harmonize through sound to these chakras as the kundalini force was rising up through the spine. Sometimes I was made to move in very particular ways. I had to go into hatha yoga postures, and it showed me that hatha yoga's origination came from this kundalini force rising up, and the body was put into these different postures in order to properly align the spine and the nervous system with this transformational energy as it came up. Sometimes I was made to dance in just very particular patterns. There were other things that I was made to do through this energy that I don't know the full reason why, other than it was changing my body. It was changing even down to my atomic cells, the structure of my body, the magnetization of this body. And through those changes, it was gradually bringing it to be a fit instrument for this higher consciousness when it comes. So I tell you these things so that if this thing should happen to you, that you have some context, you have some mental framework. If you don't know what's going on, you might feel like you're going crazy because it's so out of the ordinary. It's so out of our normal state of consciousness. And at one moment, your consciousness is lifted up and you feel the beatitude of God consciousness. And then your mind is taken down into the hell of your own being, and you're made to face all of those things that you've done in this outward journey from God. And it's very, very difficult. And that's where we need a steadiness of mind, an ability to keep our mind on the God all times. It would be like a spelunker, a cave dweller, explorer, and he gets a little lost deep down in the cave. And then suddenly he sees a little pinhole of light. and he thinks, ah, that's where the mouth of the cave is. And he starts to gradually work himself towards that pinhole of light. And as he does so, the light starts growing stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, if he takes his mind off the light, because there's some noise off in one direction, suddenly he's immersed in darkness again. He may fall into a great chasm. He may fall down and hurt himself in some way. So the important thing is this, is that when you perceive that light, when you see that light, always keep your mind on that light. If you get pulled off to the left or pulled off to the right, you can be in a great deal of trouble. So we must become very disciplined in our minds. We must become very focused in the way that we think about things. Well, the responsibility, our responsibility, for purity of thought, for complete devotion and surrender to that infinite light, has to become complete, because any little misstep off of that gains greater and greater consequences as we climb up through the spinal stairway. And so it becomes, as the Buddhists say, the razor's edge, straight down the center, not to the left, not to the right. There was once a great king story from India, and he had no heirs to his throne. So he thought, what to do? I'm going to need to have somebody who can replace me. So he called together all of his prime minister and all of his cabinet. And he said, next Thursday, I want you to come straight away to me and see me here at the castle. Well, in the meantime, he had prepared this fair all along the pathway to going to the castle. There's all kinds of entertainments and all kinds of miraculous kinds of occurrences going on left and right. And so as these ministers were walking down the path, and after a while one got very enticed by something, and so off they went one direction, and another one got drawn by something else, and off he went, and gradually they all got drawn off into something or another, except for the prime minister, and he just kept straight on to the castle. And he got to the king, and the king says, well, where are the others? He says, I don't know, sire. They got drawn off to one thing or another. He said, but you did not? He said, no, you asked me to come straightway. So here I am. He said, you are loyal to me. You get the kingdom. And so he got the kingdom, and then he had access to all the entertainments, all the things that were given at the fair along the way. But more than that, he had the keys to the kingdom. So if we make our path straightway, then we're all right. But lots of temptations come up. As we awaken to this inner sense of our being, our psychic nature opens up. We come to know other people's thoughts, other people's lives, perhaps past lives, about ourselves or others. We get this psychic intuition that begins to open up within us. We feel a sense of power, and as if we can influence things on more subtle planes. And so these are part of the entertainments that have been given on either side of the path as we make our way towards that highest kingdom. And if we get drawn off into those areas, then we begin to develop karma in those areas, the law of cause and effect. Because we're not being guided rightly, we're not being guided correctly, then we get pulled off in that area and we get lost in that area for some period of time. And it may take a very long time for us to work that out. And because we're rising up in the nature of the power that we have, the mistakes that we make are even of greater consequence than they were before. There can be wonderful divine realms where we have visions and we see beautiful creatures of God, beautiful worlds in the astral worlds. We have sublime thoughts in the causal realms. And all of these things come to take our attention away. But again, if we make that straight path, if we don't veer to the left, we don't veer to the right, but go straight to God, then we come into that kingdom. And when we have that, then we have access to all the other realms. But the mind has become purified, so we don't do anything that goes against the law of God, and in that way get ourselves into the law of cause and effect and of karma. These things come in very subtle ways. I remember when I was at Anandashram, in an ashram in the south of India, and I had met a wonderful God man, his name is Satya Sai Baba, earlier. And I was talking to one of his devotees, and they had asked me to help them with a dream that they had. And as I was helping this individual, I felt the consciousness of Satya Sai Baba on me. And I thought, oh, what a wonderful thing to be working with spiritual masters and to be having this kind of an experience. And then I noticed that there was some spiritual pride in there, that I felt a sense of quickening, but it wasn't focused on God, it was focused on the ego. And I said, no. I said, Divine Mother, take away. Excuse me. Take away all such powers from me, all such notions. I want nothing to do with them. I want to have love for you alone. And I only want to be able to awaken love for you and others. I don't want anything to do with these powers. And so for true seekers, they see powers as an obstruction, as a diversion. They come naturally, but not to give them any power, any thought. See them as coming from the source, and that it is the source, it is God who is operating through you, and that you have no part of it. You exert no will around that. But rather, if it is to come, it comes spontaneously, automatically. Perhaps you have knowledge of it, perhaps you don't. You don't have any concern one way or the other. And in that way, you make the straight path there. And we get back to that divine origin that we fell from. And sometimes people get involved in lots of astral kinds of things. That includes astral travel, psychic phenomena, development of powers, all of it, visions. But they are diversions. They seem wonderful, they seem uplifting, but they feed the ego. There's nothing about those experiences that run contrary to the ego. And a lot of times when people have those experiences, they want to rush out and write books about it and go on to television and all the rest of it. And it inflames the ego. It just heightens the sense of ego, which heightens the sense of separation. So oftentimes people don't like to hear that because they think, oh, I want some of that. But if they could know what complete realization was, they would see what faint jewels, if any, these might represent. That these are mere phantoms that come along the way. And that the jewel that is realization is so much more than what the mind can even comprehend, even think about. Whatever you think realization might be, it is only the mind's projection as to what that is. And therefore, it falls short of the real glory, the real transformation that occurs as you move into this highest state of consciousness. So I think I'll just stop there and see if there's any questions about what I've spoken on or anything else in your sadhana.
if you're going to take up diggers.
That's always the question. And especially when we're contending with the mind, that it can be very difficult to know, is this coming from my mind, or is this coming as direction from a higher source? One thing is that if we have a sense of peace, a sense of purity, a sense of stillness, one thing about the ego is it's always wanting to grasp. It wants to move out beyond itself, or it's recoiling in fear and pushing away from. So if it's rooted in extreme desire and a grasping kind of a nature, or in fear, oh no, I don't want that, and pushing away, those are the ego that is directing us at that point. If we see the direction that we're headed in, we feel at peace with ourselves, we feel in alignment with ourselves. We ask ourselves, we ask God within us, that higher source, is this right for me to go in this direction? And then instead of trying to figure it out with the intellect, we just get quiet, we get still, we get receptive. We clear away, we learn what is our own desire nature, we learn what is our own sense of repulsion for things. Because both of those have a contracting kind of nature on the self. Whereas when we feel an attunement with the light, we feel an expansiveness of the self. We feel an alignment, we feel a purity. And so it's by those qualities that we can learn to identify. Now, if we make our best decision, but it's the wrong one, and we're sincere about wanting to know the truth the right way, we'll start going down that path a little bit, and as we do, right here, we'll just start feeling worse. We'll get a soul sickness in our stomach. We'll just feel worse and worse and worse. We'll go, no, this isn't right. Now, we can override that. We can say, well, I want what I want, you know, and I don't care about this inner direction. And so we can override it. We have that choice. We always have that choice. But we just need to realize that if we make that choice and go against that higher nature, that we are further enmeshing ourselves into this world, and that there is a price to pay for that. Not because we're being punished, but it is simply the natural cause and effect that results from doing any activity. You know, if I eat food that contains more calories than what I can use in a day, then I'm going to gain weight, you know, and if I eat less calories, I'm going to lose weight. It's just a matter of physics. Every action has the same active element in it. Everything that we do has a consequence. It's like sending out a sound or a wave and then having it come back to us. And because many times it's not immediate, but it's gradual and it's cumulative and it's buildup, we think we're kind of getting away with it. But we don't. There's nothing that we do that does not come back to us. So if we sow good seeds, positive seeds, we may not see the results of that right away either, because we're still getting the results of previous actions that weren't so good. So sometimes we see a good person, and they're really doing good things in this life, and they're having a very difficult time of it. They don't have material prosperity. They don't have good physical health. There's a lot of things that seem to be wrong. And the reason is because they are still paying the consequences for things that they had done before. If you'd like, I can tell you a story that I had, experience that I had when I was at Anandashram, and I was sitting in meditation, and this vision came before my inner eye, and in it I saw myself as a young boy who was living in Russia at the time of World War II. My father was mentally not there so much. My mother had died. The town was surrounded by Germans, and excuse me, there wasn't enough food, and it was very cold, and there was no fuel, and there was a lot of suffering. And in observing this lifetime, I thought to God, I says, you know, why, here's this six-year-old boy, why is he suffering in this way? Well, in this case, God actually had an answer at the ready. And suddenly my mind was transferred to an earlier lifetime where I was part of the Mughals that had come out from Mongolia and swept across into Western Europe. And at that time, I happened to be very good as a warrior, and so I was promoted up through the ranks, and I turned out to be a governor of a Western region in the Russian area. And I had led this life of a nomad all this time, and I felt very lonely. So I had fallen in love with this woman, and she was part of the oppressed people that I was in charge of. And so she was operating out of survival, and I was operating out of my feelings at that time. During that time, she somehow betrayed me, and I had her killed. I had somebody else do it because I couldn't do it myself. And I lived out the rest of my life alone during that lifetime. I was a fairly good moguls as far as moguls went. You know, I was fair according to their traditions, which to us today would seem very barbaric. When I left that body, I rose up in consciousness, and there was this beautiful being of light. And together we reviewed my life. And of course, I felt very bad for many of the things that I did. But I was most impressed by this being of light. And I thought to myself, I would like to be like him. He has such grace. He has such love, such compassion, but it's not a weakness. There's great strength in it. And I'd never met anyone or anything like that before. And so my resolve came at that point to change my life, that's what I wanted to become like that great being that I was seeing. And so many lifetimes came after that, and working out the karma. Now, this particular lifetime that I had in Russia, I came back to. And I saw that I was suffering the consequences of before, when I had made war on people. Now war was being made on my people. When I had inflicted punishment on innocent people, here was this innocent boy and his family whose punishment was being inflicted on them. All the things that I had done, I was also a receiver of. And through that experience, there wouldn't be any time in the future that I could oppress somebody that I wouldn't identify with them subconsciously, because I would see myself as the one who was being oppressed. My mother that I had, who was taken away from me through death, was the woman that I had killed in the previous lifetime. And so I was suffering because of what I had done before. So I could never take away another person's life without, again, subconsciously identifying with that connection that I then had of somebody being taken away from me. So when we go through difficult circumstances, it teaches us compassion. And through that compassion, we get an understanding for other people. And we can no longer see somebody else as separate from ourselves, but we feel intimately tied to them, whatever their state of consciousness is. And through that compassion comes universal love and empathy. And so it's very important when we go through these states that we learn the lessons from this so that we don't repeat those things and we don't put ourselves into the jeopardy of facing those consequences again. So if we are sincere in our desire for growth and we start to move down a path and it's the wrong path for us, we'll know it. We'll start, it'll build up as pressure, as resistance. Oh, I don't like this. It doesn't feel right to me. So our sincerity is our best tool in this, pathway of going back to the light. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. It's just this whole thing unfolds. Now, we don't need to seek out past life experiences. If we do so arbitrarily, they may come to us and it may draw us into those lifetimes and we may get enmeshed in them and stuck in them once again. And sometimes we may awaken to a lifetime that we had that represents an extreme imbalance and it may awaken that tendency in us again. And so it doesn't help us in that way. But if we are deepening our sense of meditation and these things spontaneously come to us, oftentimes they're there to clear away a roadblock that otherwise keeps us from progressing forward. So if we can be attuned to that and not get caught up in the drama, but take the lesson that it represents for us and then let it go, then we don't get caught up in a brand new drama. What we don't want to do is replace one illusion with another. So if we're trying to get rid of the illusion of separation in this lifetime, we don't need to enter into one from another lifetime. Or if we want to get rid of the illusion of separation from this lifetime, we don't need to replace it with an illusion of separation in the astral realms. That's just trading one thing for another thing. So we're not making any progress then. So that's why we narrow the field of focus. We become very simple and very receptive, and we keep our mind on the light. And if we keep our mind on the light, it'll pull us through any situation. You see, as we start to awaken inwardly, you can think of the consciousness like a house. It has a basement, it has a main floor, and it has an upstairs area. And in the basement is the subconscious mind. And we have some experience and we think, nah, I don't like that experience very much. So we open the door to the basement, we throw it down in the basement, we close the door real quick. And then some other experience comes and we don't like it very much. So we open that door, we put it down there, we close the door real quick. Pretty soon the basement's getting pretty full. And the main floor is our conscious mind, what we're ordinarily conscious of. The upstairs is our superconscious mind, the area of spiritual inspiration and awakening. And so we're living on the main floor. And after a while, this aroma starts coming up from the basement. It doesn't smell very good. It comes up through the vents. And we think finally, oh, you know, this is really getting bad. I need to clean out the basement. So we open up to the door of the basement and all these things that we had put down there for so long start coming out. Now we can get caught back up in all this material that's coming out of the subconscious mind. Or we can put it into a burning barrel and let it burn up and release it. And so one thing that you can do is to imagine a light, a burning light, just above you and in front of you. And as discordant feelings and thoughts come to your conscious mind, just see them being released and flowing into this burning light and being consumed in that light. Now, sometimes people think, well, I need to examine all of these things. I need to understand why they came about and where they came from. But really, that can just be getting caught up in a different drama all over again, one that we've already lived. Occasionally, there are things that just don't leave. And those we need to say, oh, there's something here. It's a blockage. And we need to be able to name it properly. And otherwise, we just let it flow out and into the light and into the light and let the light consume it. We don't need to move into those things. We don't need to reabsorb the mind into it. That's not the same as repressing it, putting it down into the basement. It's releasing it, it's surrendering it to the divine light within. And so that's a very different thing than repressing those feelings, those thoughts, those experiences. Does that make sense? We can clear a lot of material by just releasing it as soon as it comes into our conscious mind, as soon as it comes to the main floor, and then see it go into the light and release it and release it. And we can clear a lot of material in the consciousness by doing it in that way. We don't either repress it and we don't hang on to it. We let it go. So that can save you many, many psychotherapy hours. Sometimes psychotherapists inadvertently, usually, create scenarios where we actually hold and maintain the old illusions even longer. We re-identify with them. Now, sometimes there is the case we haven't ever said something to somebody, something that's very difficult, something that we've held inside. And it can be very useful to let that out. That can be cathartic, and we're letting it go. But there's a line that comes in that when we start to actually start giving it energy, we build an identity around that. And then we're actually giving it new energy, and we're not releasing it any longer. Any other questions or comments? One way, if you want to get also, if you want to get rid of past material, is to write it all out. Sit down. If you feel like there's some things that you need to get rid of, with a pen and a paper, and just start writing. And don't even think about what you're going to write. Just let your hand write it. Pages and pages, however much comes out, continue on. And then you go inside and you ask yourself, am I ready to release this? And if the answer comes out yes, then you go outside to the barbecue or to some pit someplace where you can light a fire. You lit a fire and let it all go up. And when you see the smoke go up, just see all your past karma going up with it. And release it. Release it. Let it go. Don't need to hang on to it anymore.
It's a big bonfire. So when people, let's say, well, this sort of like, Kundalini, because I feel kind of experience, but that I know many people that did experience, and some of them have very powerful awakening.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it a cause for them to be very sick and very ill?
Mm-hmm. unfortunately, there's not many qualified people who can help somebody when they have those kinds of experiences. As the saying goes, it takes one to know one. Just having read some books or done some studying on it doesn't qualify someone to help another through those experiences. But one who has gone through those experiences and come to a state of realization, then they can help another one do that. Sometimes, because we're not properly taught how to take care of those experiences when they come, how to properly focus our mind, the energy gets diverted into wrong channels. And as a result, it causes distress to the physical body, to the emotional body, to the mental body. So it's not something just to kind of play with. It's something that must be taken seriously. And I don't agree with these people who go around and do these workshops. 99% of the people have no awakening of Kundalini, so they're all right. But every once in a while they may trigger a reaction, and a strong reaction at someone, and then they don't know what to do with them. You say, well, that's not like anybody else's. It's supposed to be pleasant and even. And some people's awakening comes in very gradual ways. Other people have more dramatic kinds of awakenings. It depends on our own individual karma and how we go about living our sadhana, our spiritual discipline. Sadhana is really a preparation for that higher consciousness to come in. If we were to be imbued with that consciousness now, it would literally burn out our nervous system. And it would overwhelm us emotionally and mentally. There was a spiritual master, Ramakrishna Paramahansa, and he had Vivekananda come to him. His name was Narendra at the time. He was a student in law school. And he asked Ramakrishna, he was there to get teachings and to study with him. Ramakrishna walked up to him and slapped him gently on the chest. And suddenly the swirling motion started in his whole being, and Narendra says, what are you doing? What are you doing? Stop this, stop this, make it stop. And then Ramakrishna hit him again on the chest, and it all calmed down. He wasn't yet ready to have that experience. And so it was, you know, because of his mental state, because he was not yet prepared for that experience, then it was throwing him off balance. It created fear in him. And so fear on the spiritual path is one of our great obstacles. And we cultivate a fearless attitude, which doesn't mean that we act foolishly. It just means that we cultivate an attitude of overcoming our fears, that we don't give in to them. And that we bring ourselves into that state where our faith is so firm, so clear, that we know that we're being protected. We know that whatever is happening to us is fulfilling a higher divine will. And through that knowledge, that's our connection with the divine life that's within us. And through that connection, that brings us safety. That brings our life into harmony, because we're harmonizing our mind, our thoughts, with the divine life. But if we get pulled off to the left or to the right, and we get scared by what we see, and we lose connection with that light, and we get preoccupied with those things that are coming at us, then we can be in real trouble. So a very steady mind, and one that keeps us going in the right direction at all times, is required. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, you know, it's difficult. There's a book written by Gopi Krishna called Kundalini that talked about he even tried to find a teacher and he couldn't when he started having these experiences. He didn't know what was going wrong. He thought he was going crazy. And it's very, very difficult. Those things aren't said to frighten you, but only that these things need to be taken with a sober mind and not just a too casual attitude. We need to be sincere in our seeking. Spiritual path is not for wimps.
So you would say as the Kundalini awakening as the movement, and a person will slowly heal physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually?
It's meant to do all of those things for us. But we have to be willing to do our part.
So the Kundalini could start to move and awaken, and we could be affected on the four levels, mm-hmm. and maybe not have healing from that. Like we could say, have physical affliction and it could stay with us through this life.
If we're too far out of balance, or it is involved in healing us, but the healing doesn't become complete, either because we're not cooperating with it very well, or there's just a lot of karma to move out of the way. But whatever progress we make in this lifetime will carry over to the next lifetime. There's the story of Narendra, who was a great devotee, and he was with Krishna in heaven one day. And he decided to go for a walk. So he came down to earth and he's walking along on a path. He saw there a man who was meditating. He'd been meditating there for so long, and still for so long, that ants had built up an anthill around him, and just his head stuck out of the top of this anthill. Well, the man sensed that a great being was walking towards him. And so he said, "Ah, Narendra," he says, "when you see Krishna, will you ask him, how long will it be until I get realization?" Narendra said, "Yes, of course." And he continued to walk on his way. He saw another man. He appeared to be drunk or crazy or something. He was trying to put a post into a hole, but he was in such an inebriated state, he couldn't seem to find the hole correctly. But when he saw Narendra, he looked at him straight in the eye, he dropped the pole, he went over and he says, "Narendra, if you see Krishna, will you ask him how many lifetimes before I get realization?" Narendra said, "Yes, of course." So he continued on his way. He went back into heaven with Krishna. He asked the questions, and then another day he was walking along on the same path. He comes along with the man who had been sitting there for so long in the anthill. The man sensed a great being coming again, and so he opened his eyes and said, "Ah, Narendra, did you see Krishna? Did you ask him?" "Yes, I did, my son." He says, "Only three more lifetimes and you'll have full realization." "Three lifetimes? I've been sitting here for 60 years and three more lifetimes? I've had it. Why have I gone away from things of the world when all of this is doing me no good at all?" And he breaks apart the anthill and he gives up and he walks off. Narendra was quite shocked at this. He thought, "My, I expected nothing like that from this man at all." So he continues to walk down on the path a while longer. And he sees this other man. He still seems to be crazed or inebriated or something. He's still trying to put the same post into the same hole, and he's swearing at God, and he's carrying on. And so finally, he sees Narendra, and he says, "Ah, Narendra," drops the pole. Immediately, he sobers up. He says, "Did you see Krishna? Did he tell you? How many lifetimes will I see him?" He says, "Yes, my son, I did." He said, "See yonder tree over there? All the leaves on that tree?" "Oh, yes." He says, "As many leaves on that tree, as many lifetimes before you realize God." "Oh, I am assured that I will know God. I am assured I have complete peace of mind now that one day I will know God. And then this voice came down and said, no, my son, not so long. You shall have me now.
Wow.
So when we have that kind of surrender, that God is always working in our best interest. When we really trust in that, and that divine consciousness, we're never separated from it. So that whatever situation is in our life, whatever person is before us, that is God in human form, come to help us work out our karma. And when we quit thinking all the time, oh, that person needs a psychologist to help them out. Look at all the things that are wrong with them. And we start listing all the things down. And all we see is everybody else's fault and how the world has fallen short of our expectations. And we turn that around and we say, this world is exactly as it ought to be. And this person has come to me. It is God in human form who has come to teach me the lessons. Maybe they're a perfect example of what not to be. And so I'm seeing it played out because I obviously have that somewhere in my own deep unconscious mind. So it's being played out in front of me. It's a wonderful living color example of what not to be. Or this person is testing me to grow in strength, grow in compassion, grow in love, whatever the lesson might be, but the lesson is for me. And it's not about me fixing the world or me fixing God. It's about me changing myself and seeing every person and every situation as a lesson for me in that. And when we see that, can you see how that changes your relationship with this life and living this life? When you begin to see, not that this person has a whole list of things to fix about themselves, but that they're perfect in the way that they come to us, that they are God wearing a mask, perfectly designed for us. Now that doesn't make us a doormat. Sometimes somebody comes to us to test our own internal fortitude. Can we stand up and say what is true in the face of somebody who makes that difficult to do? Can we maintain our composure and our peace even in a difficult situation? Can we speak our truth when it's not welcome, if that's what we feel directed to do? So it's not just submitting ourselves to every terrible thing that comes along, but it is recognizing, embedded in that situation, embedded in our relationship with that person, lies the key to my spiritual growth. And that if I see it that way, then I start taking benefit of it. I start realizing the fullness of what that means to me. And where before I may have seen somebody full of what they lacked, suddenly I see myself in what I lack. Of course, that's much harder. And so we prefer to run around and tell everybody else what they lack. What's harder is to take a thorough self-assessment and to say, ah, this is calling on me to let go of anger when I meet with anger. It's calling on me to have compassion. It's calling on me to take that risk of opening myself up to another person, whatever the case may be. It's designed exactly for me. And if you can start to cultivate that attitude, you can imagine how that could change your life. And so Swami Ram Dass wrote one of his books and called The World is God. And when Swami Satchidananda first read something by Swami Ram Dass, he wasn't a Swami. Swami Satchidananda wasn't a Swami then. And one of the things that he read that Papa Ram Dass wrote was that the world is exactly as it ought to be. And Swami Satchidananda had a very interesting, you know, we might have all kinds of reactions to reading that. We might just skip right over it. We might dismiss it in some way or just say, of course. But he thought it would take a very great soul to be able to say something like that. I want to meet that one. And so he set out to do that. And he became his guru and helped to change his life. So it's quite something if you think the world is exactly the way it ought to be. That includes you. Can you accept yourself? You are God in human form. God has come through you to experience this world, to play in this world, to learn in this world, to bring your light into this world. And that's not something to build the ego up. When you get in relationship with that, you feel very humbled by it. You feel as if you are nothing, and that divine life in you is everything. And so, let your lights shine. Let your love flow to this world. See this world with divine vision. Rest no longer easy in just a human perception of this world, but grow to see it in its true and its divine origin. And it will change your life. It will transform you. And you will become that which you have always been. Only we've fallen asleep. It's like we're sleepwalkers. We're involved in a dream. And we've even forgotten that we're dreaming. We think this is all and all. And it's that much. It's that much. This vast being resides underneath your conscious mind, vast beyond measure. And that is you, and you are that. But we remain content. Being satisfied with this, we're like little beggars. Instead of proclaiming, you know, there's a wonderful story of the lion. The mother lion was one day very hungry and was very large with a cub inside and went running after some sheep in order to get some food. Well, it just died of exhaustion right there. But when it died, it gave birth also to this new cub. So this cub lion came out and looked around and saw the sheep, and the sheep weren't particularly afraid of the cub and started licking it, and it just took one of the sheep as its mother's. And so it grew up thinking that it was a sheep, and it went around, bah, bah, learned how to bah even. And so it's running around, this lion is, with this big mane and, you know, running all over like a sheep. Well, one day another lion comes hunting. And it's so amazed to see, as it chases this, all these sheep, that there's a lion in the midst, and it's going, bah, bah, as they're running along. And it says, this indignity is too much. I can't handle it. Here is a proud lion running around like a sheep. What is his problem? What is going on here? So he runs over to the lion, and he knocks him down. Well, the lion's really scared, because he thinks he's a sheep. It's getting knocked down by this lion. This lion says, what do you think you're doing? You're a lion, and you're running around as a sheep. He says, Bob, I'm just a poor little sheep. Please don't hurt me. Please don't kill me. What? Why are you acting like this? And it drug it over to some water that was still and said, look, look at your reflection. You are a lion, and you're acting like this little sheep. And it looked in and saw its reflection. Oh, it hadn't ever seen its nature like that before. and awakened to the idea that it was a lion and not a little sheep. And that's what the great saints and gurus do for us, is that they awaken us to our true nature. We run around thinking we're little sheep, but we're great lions of God. And they show us our own reflection, and it startles us. We think, oh, I never knew. I never knew. Maybe I hoped, maybe I thought, but I always thought that I was a little sheep. So for all of us to awaken to become great lions and not little sheep. Is that it?
I had a question. It's quite a complex question. Sometimes I keep repeating in my mind. And I'm kind of confused about God's will, destiny, and karma. Like, what I believed and grew up was, like, so shall you sow is so shall you reap. Maybe we might not reap all in this birth,
right,
maybe the next birth.
Yes.
Our karma's with evidence. But then I hear whatever God wants us to do. It's like we just like puppets in his hand.
And do we have free will or not?
But I thought we had a free will. And he's given us the choices. And that's where the karma's kick in. Right?
Yes.
But then they say, well, if you were destined to be there or do this, or it's all jumble mumble.
My guru, my teacher, was in India one time, and she was having a conversation with a saint there, Sri Anomaly. He was down in Madras, now called Chennai. And he was Advaitin, he only oneness of God and nothing else. So he said, man has no free will. God does everything, and if God intends for something to happen, then it happens. And if he doesn't, it doesn't. And Mother says, she called him Swamiji. No, Swamiji, I don't agree. I think man has free will. Back and forth they went for quite a while. Finally, she went inside and she says, God, I know I'm right on this. You have to help me win this one. So then she said, Swamiji, he says, yes. He says, you are an Advaitin. You believe only in oneness of God. Yes. She says, are we also part of God? Yes, that is true. And God has free will? Oh, yes, God has free will. Well, if God has free will, and I am a part of God, then I must have free will also. He had a kind of a stunned look on his face for a little bit. So that's the only problem with her. She thinks too fast for me in English. Because all the devotees were sitting around. He didn't want to look too bad. So when we wake up in the morning, we decide, oh, instead of getting up to meditate, I think I want to roll over and I want to go sleep for a little while longer. You know, we make decision, you know, about what kind of mood we want to have one day. Oh, I kind of have a sour mood today, but I could work on changing that. I could cheer myself up, try to take another perspective. We have, at every moment, we can choose how we put our attention on this world. We don't always choose what comes into our life. We have disease, we don't have disease. We have prosperity, we don't have prosperity. We have friends, we don't have friends. There's war, there's not war. So many things that are outside of our direct influence. But that if we choose, we can change our attitude about that, and therefore our experience of it. And as I was speaking of earlier, if you see, oh, this is God come to me, suddenly same experience is there, but the experiencer has changed. And how you perceive it, how you have that experience, makes a huge difference in the attitude that you have. So it's said that attitude determines altitude. So good attitude takes you up, bad attitude takes you down. And that we can choose. We can choose how we direct this mind. When we make actions, maybe we're presented with something, but we make a choice, do I want to go with it or not go with it? And even if somebody holds a gun in our head and says, you do this or else, well, there's even a choice in that. There is the or else. And so we can say, yes, I choose this way or that way. So I think that we have free will, and that everything is dependent upon how we focus our attention. Doesn't necessarily bring us all the outward things that we want, because karma is still there. We still get the reverberations of what we've done from before. But it can change how we experience those events that come to us. And if we see it as God, if we see it, the world is exactly as it ought to be. And as I say, that doesn't mean we're a doormat. Well, treat me any way you want to. No, that experience may be calling on us to say, I have self-respect here, and I should be treated with respect, even as I should hold you in respect. So it works both ways, but it doesn't make us a doormat. But we do see that that experience is designed perfectly for us. So does that help?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So all circumstances are not under our control. In fact, when we think about our lives, we see how pitifully few circumstances are inside of our control. So many things. Is it going to rain today, not rain today? You know, does my supervisor think well of me, and will I get a raise or won't I? We can try to do a good job, but they may just not like us for some reason. And that may be part of our karma. And part of that may be, is this the right job for me? Or do I need to stand up to this person in some way? Or do I need to learn how to accept this more? So there's no absolute rule that you can say, this is always the lesson. It changes from moment to moment to moment. At some point, the lesson may be to yield. It may be to surrender. It may be to let go. At another moment, it may be to stand up and be strong and say, no, this is not right. Like that. So free will is there.
No, I believed in that.
Mm-hmm.
I believed in free will. Mm-hmm. God's given us a free will.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the negative aspects that has, I think it's inaccuracy, but with karma sometimes comes fatalism. It's bound to happen. Yes, but I think Yogananda used to tell astrologers, he says, you tell me my worst days, and I'll still accomplish everything that I set out to do. He would come up against uncommon difficulties, but he would still accomplish what he set out to do. So calling, especially when you connect your will with God's will, that becomes stronger than karma. And Papa Ram Dass used to say he played football with the stars. So that kind of fatalism, that kind of, oh, it's going to happen, there's nothing I can do about it, you know, I'm just getting buffeted around here in the winds, and I have, no, you are made in the image and the likeness of God. Image is form. You have a causal body, you have an astral body, you have a physical body, so you are made in that same construction as God has formed his body. excuse me, you are made in the likeness, which is the spirit that resides beyond all creation. And when you access that, you access a power that has more power than anything in creation. Mother used to say, if you want to get something done in a company, go right to the president of the company. And if he agrees, then everything, everybody else falls into line with that. If you go to middle management, you may get a yes, but it doesn't happen. That kind of thing. She says, even so, go to the president of the universe. Win his approval, everything else happens as a natural course from that. So don't mess around with middle management. Go right to the source. Anything else? I just want to say that it's been a lovely time here in Prince Rupert. We've had some lovely sessions. I've enjoyed it a great deal. Sometimes people say, was it a good talk? And I say, I don't know, but I enjoyed it thoroughly. Not sure what anybody else would say, but I loved it. And getting together and speaking of God and of the spiritual path is, I can't think of anything better to do in the world. So thank you for giving me that opportunity. Namaste. I bow to the light within you. And we have some prasad. Do we have two things of prasad? You brought some also? I have some prasad here and I have some spoons, so.